Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This edition of Nature Bats Last, like future episodes, is pre-recorded. As a result, there's no chance to take your questions on the air for tonight's March 24th, 2015 episode of Nature Bats Last. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by AfraZen. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud. That's SoundCloud.com.
Today's show will highlight Guy's YouTube channel, Nature Bats Last, which is a new video series which debuted earlier this year, and it's called The Edge of Extinction. But first, the good doctor is back in the studio, so let's get an update on his travels. He's been gone a month. Guy, what's been going on? It's been quite a road trip.
Thanks, Mike. It has been quite a road trip. I went coast to coast, started in New York, spent quite a bit of time in New York City, and ended up in California and spent nearly 2 weeks in and around Berkeley and Chico and so on. And I should have known better. As soon as I got to New York, got in pretty late in the evening and walked up the two or three stairs of my hostess's house and pulled on the doorknob, and the door was locked. And I'm just loaded up with all this stuff. And I didn't think the door would be locked. So I slipped, fell backwards down the two or three concrete steps, landed in a heap on the asphalt parking lot. And then for the next week, I felt like I did when I was a sophomore in high school doing two-a-day football practices. It just hurt everywhere. I can't believe how horrible a shape I'm in.
I'm not 29 anymore.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. And then the next day, there was 8 inches of fresh snow on the ground. So I thought, well, this is kind of fun. I haven't shoveled snow for a while. Turns out it's not all that fun. Who'd have thunk it? So I shoveled the snow out of the 100-foot driveway, and then we took off to go to Rhode Island, where I did an event there. And so that didn't really help matters with respect to my muscle torture that was going on. But all was really good in New York. I had to skip one event because there was cars stacked up all the way from Westchester County to New York City because of the weather, which was horrific there.
So no more East Coast trips during the winter?
I think that's probably a good idea.
Note to self.
Yes. And so then I flew from LaGuardia to Charlotte to Phoenix to San Jose, and it was 5.5 hours from Charlotte to Phoenix. And I was trapped. I was trapped in a window seat, which almost never happens to me. But I had a sort of issue with the airline. They couldn't change a seat and blah, blah, blah. So I was trapped in this window seat, and the two people beside me were fat, old, chain-smoking Americans.
Is there any other time?
And so I didn't want to push past them. They didn't move the whole flight. I didn't want to push it. I was half asleep anyway because I started the whole thing at 3 o'clock in the morning. And so I just stayed there with my nose glued to the window the whole time. So by the time I got to California, little did I know at the time, but I developed a pulmonary embolism, apparently.
Wow.
Blood clotted in a calf and traveled up my lungs, and it was pretty ugly.
So what were the symptoms that sent you to the hospital eventually?
Well, that night I got in, you know, pretty late. It was a more than 24-hour day. Because I got up on the East Coast at about 11 p.m. West Coast time to go to the airport, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, by the time I got to bed, I figured I was pretty dehydrated and tired, so I didn't pay much attention to the cramps in my calves when I was trying to sleep. But I kept having to get up and shake out my calves and stretch a little bit.
Yeah.
But I thought, yeah, it's just from dehydration and I'm tired and blah, blah, blah. Well, by the next day, I had this shooting pain on my right side and my chest and going up to my shoulder and shooting down my arm. And so I asked the people who were traveling with me, which side is it when it's a heart attack? Is it the left side or the right side? And they go, why? I said, because it's the right side. And they go, oh, that's really nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
So I figured it was nothing to worry about.
They know.
Right, exactly. And so when I woke up the next morning, I knew something was seriously wrong. And when I said I woke up the next morning, I didn't really sleep much that night because of the pain in my right side. And I couldn't lie down either because my right lung hurt so badly.
Wow.
It turns out this is the lung responding to the embolism, trying to do something about it. And you know what happens when we try to do something.
Right. We almost always make it worse.
Yeah, we screw it up.
Yeah, so the lung is just a microcosm of our whole society. Yeah. Really. And so I went to the ER pretty early the next day. That was Friday the 6th, I believe. And I spent all day in the ER Friday. And I'm always so arrogant when I go to the doctor because
just
I have
the doctor.
Okay, I'm always so arrogant all the time. And I had the diagnosis all worked out.
Yeah. Well, you are a doctor.
Well, I know it. I know it. And I've seen one on TV.
Right, and you've seen one.
And so I had the diagnosis all figured out. I went and told the doctor, the ER doc, I think it's a gallbladder issue. It's probably you should do this, that, and the other thing. And he pokes me a few times in various soft spots in my body, which I didn't realize were so numerous until then. And he says, that hurt? No. Does that hurt? No, that doesn't hurt. Then it's not gallbladder. But I wanted to say, okay, I'd be right.
Yeah.
And so he did a CT scan and found out it was pulmonary embolism and put me on a bunch of anticoagulants to try to get rid of it. So for 9 days in a row, twice a day, I shot myself with a syringe full of Lovenox right in the belly.
Wow.
Fortunately, I have a bunch of more belly fat than I used to, thanks to the New York part of the trip. So it wasn't really all that painful. But it was awful. I mean, and you'd think it would be one of those things that would get better over time. You'd be more accustomed to it. With such luck. It got worse every time. I just knew it was coming.
Yeah.
And then sure enough, ow, shit, it hurt again. now my belly's fat and it's all black and bruised. It's really pretty hideous because these anticoagulants make me bruise and bleed easily.
Wow. And so where are you now as far as health?
Well, it's hard to say. I'm going to a local doctor again today. I've received input from 5 doctors so far, and they all tell me to just basically keep doing what you're doing, and the anticoagulants should work and take care of this clot and any others that developed at the time. And just use better behavior when you're on the plane, which I knew.
Yeah.
You know, I could sort of feel, as I was sitting there, I thought, this is just wrong, but I kept nodding off to sleep, and I had my nose pushed up against the window so I couldn't smell the chain-smoking stuff on the clothes of those people. And so I just didn't really think much of it.
Yeah.
And then it just sneaked up on me. But generally, my health is good. My lung doesn't hurt anymore, and I'm up and around. If I didn't have this cold, I'd sound a little better.
Right.
But I think it's all going to be okay, to quote Katie Goodman in the broadcast.
Right. Tambourine! So, that happened in the beginning of the West Coast trip. So what happened with the West Coast trip?
Well, as it turns out, I was going to participate in a workshop put on by Andrew Harvey and Terry Patton for the first 4 days. I went to the first evening's worth of activities, and it was driving back from that I ask if it's the right side or the left side, which is the one I need to worry about. And so I missed that workshop for the next 3 days.
Okay.
And so it wasn't something I was putting on. Yeah. I missed an opportunity to interact with some folks, but really that was about it. As far as my speaking part of the tour and my facilitating workshops, there was no great loss. We did, I think, a stellar job developing the workshop and delivered it twice on the East Coast, and Pauline Schneider and I had an opportunity to fix it so it's in pretty good shape, and then did a minor tweak on it between the first and second time it was delivered on the West Coast.
Yeah, this is the grief workshop.
Well, it's a reality workshop.
Okay.
Really.
We don't like that word.
Well, when you use the word grief, it turns people away.
That's true.
They don't want to show up because...
They like reality?
So for a while, we called it the Climate Reality Acceptance Process, but nobody liked the acronym.
Which is?
Climate Reality Acceptance Process.
Oh,
it's the crap workshop.
Yeah, crappy.
Yeah, so, well, it's really shitty information we're giving out. Reality is like, so we call it Abrupt Climate Change, How Will You Show Up During Humanity's Final Chapter.
Okay.
And
it's catchier.
Oddly, that has people showing up.
Yeah. That's a good marketing thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Good niche there. It's a big dollar on that.
Yeah. Me and Bill Hicks. We're all over this.
Right.
And it was really, the workshop was good, each of the places we delivered it. And I was surprised when the 2 times we delivered it, once in Grass Valley, Nevada City, mm-hmm. and once in Chico in California. And both times there were a bunch of, wait for it, middle-aged white men there.
Really?
And that's never happened before. Yeah. That's where I get the most pushback.
Yeah.
Is from people like me,
right.
and even a little older, who are sort of at the apex of privilege right. in this society. But there were a bunch of people who looked a lot like me.
And how did they react?
And they reacted really, really favorably.
Yeah. See, we're coming around. We're coming around. These white guys are coming around.
It's weird.
Yeah. Took 500 years. A lot of genocide, but...
Yeah, collateral damage.
Right, yeah, right.
So it was pretty uplifting doing workshops and seeing the response to them. And people were very supportive during and after the workshops. They were very, very well received.
Yeah.
So that was good.
And so you figure, I mean, how many times have you done this workshop total now?
Some version of it, I think 6 times and 4 times on this trip.
Yeah.
And really, it has evolved
a lot. Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
In the last 8 months.
Each time you do it, you go, oh, maybe we should try this or not do that.
Right. And one of the big changes this time was focusing. We're having difficulty making the transition from concrete examples, personal examples of grief that we're all familiar with. So we want to present those mm-hmm. because that's how people can engage, is right. if they've had personal experience. And we're having difficulty bridging from there to anticipatory grief at scale, which means hundreds of species going extinct every day yeah. and continuing into the future, and ultimately all of the human species going away.
Right.
That's anticipatory grief at scale. And we discovered, as a result of the Grass Valley Nevada City workshop, a nice tool to do that, and that's our host Caroline in Grass Valley said that she wrote a letter and prepared one of the exercises not on a personal basis as we asked her to,
right,
but instead she wrote to nature and wrote about her relationship with nature.
Yeah.
So one of the things we do is prepare a relationship graph. This woman has lost 2 husbands.
Wow.
And the greatest grief for her is what's going on in nature.
Yeah.
And so she wrote about that. That's the relationship that she has felt the most strongly about, which is pretty astonishing. Then when we had other people do that, it just opened the door yeah. in a way that we never imagined would happen.
Well, this is stuff that's never, at least that I'm aware of, at least in this culture, that's never happened before. So you're really, in a way, you're kind of breaking ground here, but you're finding new things out each time you do it. Because when you say at scale, nothing's ever been done, grief or not, at this scale.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so we give you a few examples of what are relatively minor events in comparison. Like, and I hate to use the word minor event when we're referring to the Holocaust
right.
in the 1930s and the 1940s. But
7 billion versus...
Right.
7 billion people. We're just talking people in this case.
That's right. That's right.
We're not talking all species.
Right. So we use as examples the Holocaust. And this one especially affects vegans, CAFOs, you know, these controlled animal feeding operations
right.
that we enslave animals into so mm-hmm. that we can have a little comfort along the way.
Right.
And those are the kinds of, and of course we don't need to anticipate the grief associated with 150 to 200 species that we drive to extinction every day. Yeah. But that's the kind of scale of events we're talking about.
Yeah.
And so that makes it a little easier for people to identify with what we're talking about. Also, significant events in our own history, such as 9/11 and how people responded to that.
I mean, it's interesting because I brought this up before in a previous episode, you know, Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. In his manifesto, he talks about hidden relationships and the hidden relationships that, you know, take place in the development of things we like, for example, cell phones, and we don't see the nature, the ecosystems that are involved and the destruction that's involved and the destruction of human lives and people that are exploited along the way and the phone gets buried in a landfill and so on and so forth and, you know, can poison water systems and blah, blah, blah. So in some levels, it's interesting to me that people feel grief for something that they can't necessarily see or touch. In this culture, that seems it's particularly odd because it's really hard to get people to feel any sort of empathy about the environmental crisis because they can't really, in some cases, touch it. You know, ice is melting somewhere. They know that.
Right. Right. No, I think empathy, and I've thought for a long time, empathy is the most important thing we can learn.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to teach it. It's one of the most difficult things to try to transmit to people, to put yourself in somebody else's shoes, mm-hmm. much less in the shoes of an other with which we have great difficulty identifying.
Yeah.
Another species, another race of individual, another gender.
Right.
No, those things are tough, granted. And so for some people, it's obviously more difficult than others. And it seems like, to me anyway, the people who are at the apex of privilege, which means white men in this culture, mm-hmm. have the greatest difficulty expressing empathy.
Yeah, and no doubt in the conversations that I've had over the years, that's definitely true. So do you think the workshop takes people to a place where they can empathize?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. Okay. You should have seen the tears.
Yeah.
I mean, people are really connecting to other people in their lives and to the natural world in a way that they have not connected in many cases ever,
right?
Or at least for a very long time, because we're such a grief-denying and death-denying culture that we just don't do grief. We have all these myths associated with the concept of grieving in this culture that sort of force us to push it away.
Yeah, and yet it's right under the surface because it actually doesn't take too much to peel it away.
That's right. That's right. And then this culture comes up with all these actions we should take mm-hmm. to further push it away. Yeah. You know, big boys don't cry.
Right.
Time heals all wounds.
Yeah.
You know, grieve alone.
Rub some dirt on it.
Right. Yes. Here you go. And so it seems rather ludicrous. But here we are in the land of ludicrous. So
right.
Why should that surprise us?
Right.
Anyway, all in all, a successful tour, albeit somewhat painful on many fronts for me. It's good to be back home where I'll rest for a couple of weeks after seeing a doctor today.
Mm-hmm.
He might have me resting for a lot longer than I think. We'll see. Well, let's get started. Today, Mike and I will play a series of episodes from The Edge of Extinction, which is on the Nature Bats Last YouTube channel. And then we'll discuss and maybe update some things along the way. Let's begin with episode 2 from The Edge of Extinction. And a short correction before we start here. In this episode, I say that the British Parliament predicted the loss of Arctic ice by September of this year. That's not right. That's an error. However, at this point, we are at the lowest Arctic ice in history for January, February, and March. So it looks like this could be the year that we experience an ice-free Arctic. And I can't imagine we make it more than a couple of years down the road before that happens. So
this clip is called How Long Do We Have?
How Long Do We Have? There we go.
I'm Guy McPherson, and this is The Edge of Extinction, a part of Nature Bats Last. Thanks for joining in for this second episode of Edge of Extinction. I pointed out in the premiere episode of Edge of Extinction that when industrial civilization collapses, that will cause an immediate warming of the planet, which will almost certainly lead to the loss of all ice in the Arctic and the release of that 50 gigaton burp of methane that Natalia Shukova warns is highly likely at any time. Well, it can go the other way as well. That 50 gigaton burst of methane, according to Shukova, is, quote, highly likely at any time or highly possible at any time. So it's lying there ready to come out. And the ice in the Arctic is in major demise. And when that 50 gigaton burp comes out conservatively, it will cause a global average temperature rise of 1.3 degrees centigrade above where we are now, which takes us above 2C for the global average. And when that happens, civilization fails because civilization is based on the ability to grow grains. Those are grown in the interior of large continents, mostly in the northern hemisphere. And 2C is the upper limit, global average, for holding civilization together for the ability to grow grains, because that means at least 4C in the interior of large continents. So if we lose the ice first, then civilization will fail in the not-too-distant future, probably the following year, the following growing season in the Northern Hemisphere. So if all the ice is gone in September 2015, as predicted by the UK Parliament, for example, or 2016, as suggested by the US Naval Postgraduate School, then the following summer, 2016, 2017, civilization fails, and we end up with the same outcome. We end up with 1.3C plus 1.4C, taking us to that 3.55C, a third of a degree centigrade above a temperature that has harbored humans in the past on this planet. So it seems it doesn't matter to me. We maintain civilization, which is a heat engine, and that causes the loss of Arctic ice, which causes the collapse of civilization. Or we experience the collapse of civilization, which causes the loss of sea ice. They're joined at the hip, as it were. So loss of civilization or loss of sea ice means loss of the other, regardless. It works the same either way. The math is the same. We experience very rapid rise in global average temperature in a very short period of time. I have great news for deniers of climate change who also practice Christianity. Scientists now agree that prayer is the only thing that can save us from climate change. With that in mind, remember, at the edge of extinction, only love remains.
Okay, so how long do we have?
Well, that's the $64 million question everybody who listens to me speak comes up afterwards, or a lot of people come up afterwards and say, what's my expiration date?
Yeah.
You know, everybody wants to know. And I think the whole thing is really unfair. I think instead of having a birth date, we should have a death date posted on us when we're born. That would make things a whole lot easier.
And we'd live quite differently, that's for sure.
Yes, absolutely.
Although, that being said, I'm still fascinated that the people that, you know, I hate to use this word, get near-term human extinction. And there's plenty of them out there. I mean, most of them, you know, they're our listeners, 1,800 a week. On some levels, they're not living the lives the way they really want to, in what you call doing what you love. They're still kind of doing things they dread.
Yes.
Even though they accept near-term human extinction, they're still, I don't know, putting themselves through the gauntlet.
Yeah, I mean, the shackles of empire, the shackles of civilization are really, really tight, mm-hmm. really, really strong. I mean, I can understand the concept of living in two worlds, and yeah. That's where we are. Everybody feels like they have to make money, and they do.
Yeah, you got to eat. I get that, right.
You're going to survive in this culture. And so people find it difficult to break those bonds. I understand that. I understand it particularly well since I got $800, $900 worth of shots to stick into my belly fat for 90 cents.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because of insurance.
Right.
Because my wife is still shackled to the system,
right.
as it were.
Right.
And so I get that there are advantages associated with living within the system.
Yeah.
And it's hard to break away. You know, my wife would love to accompany me in on the European tour next month.
Right.
But somebody's got to pay the bills.
Right, right.
So,
well, I think as we transition to the next clip, you know, and part of getting to that point is, and you talk about this, you know, breaking those shackles, and part of it is actually questioning the dominant paradigm, which most people who listen to this show have clearly done. And you had an interesting discussion interview that you did not too long ago. And I think this next clip called Questioning the Dominant Paradigm is from that.
You know, the whole thing. And questioning the dominant paradigm within the dominant paradigm is a fool's errand.
Do you ever listen or read any of the things that Noam Chomsky writes?
Oh, yes.
I mean, there's a good example of, even if you don't agree with even most of what he says, and I happen to agree with most of what he says, we don't have that. That's not part of the legitimate discourse. in our society.
That's right.
You never hear religion questioned. You never hear capitalism questioned. You never hear our foreign policy questioned. It's great to be a member of the empire, though.
So who was that?
That was Paul Ehrlich. I interviewed him, must be about a month or so ago now. And, you know, he wrote the book, The Population Bomb, published in 1968. So he knows all about speaking and writing sort of outside the dominant paradigm.
He walked this road well before any of us did.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, that book came out when I was 8 years old.
Yeah.
And I had an opportunity to have dinner with him and his wife, Anne, on this trip. That was great fun.
Yeah.
Because we got to talk about some of the similarities of the paths we've taken.
Right.
The big difference being that he's at Stanford, and he said he has never met any resistance from any faculty or staff about anything he's ever written.
That's amazing.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, you know, it's Stanford.
Right. And he points out this might be one of the big differences between private schools and public schools.
Yeah.
You know, because public schools are deeply embedded within the dominant paradigm.
Yeah.
And maybe it's a little easier for a Stanford and Princeton to break out of that a little bit.
And he's still teaching.
And he's still teaching at the age of 82.
Wow.
And it's funny because when we talk about that to him,
yeah.
He said, he asked me why I left the university. And I said, well, my final department head was hired specifically to make my life miserable enough that I would leave. Her first administrative act was to ban me from teaching in my home department. Yeah. And he says, really? I love it if somebody banned me from teaching.
Did you go to U of A?
But that's what I love to do,
yeah,
is to teach. And so not being able to do that was a big assault and insult for me.
Right.
Would have been a big favor as far as he was concerned.
Yeah. And he's one of the few, you know, white men who's been doing this a long time. You know, most of these guys are going, you know, Vonnegut's gone and George Carlin is gone and Howard Zinn is gone and who knows how long Noam's going to be around. So he's kind of one of the...
I hope you're not listening, no.
No.
No offense.
Who knows how long any of us are going to be around.
That's right.
So,
that's exactly right.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, so Addo, it was a great conversation with him a month or two ago. Was drawn, and then the conversation continued and was equally excellent when we were there in Palo Alto. So that was big fun.
Right on.
So
our next clip, well, I think it kind of speaks for itself. It's called The Unspeakable. So let's hear that and we'll comment.
What kinds of reactions do you have? Because whenever I bring up your work, I must say people get extremely angry with me, go into total denial, say that I'm trying to attack the very foundations of human decency. It is so hard to start a conversation about the unspeakable, isn't it?
Yes, yes it is. And so I receive, in response to my message, which really isn't my message, it's just connecting the dots from other scientists. I haven't conducted primary research for 6 years now. And so really I'm just accumulating this information that other scientists are putting out, like Paul Beckwith, for example, and hundreds of articles now from the Refereed Journal literature pointing us down this wayward path. The response I receive was clearly described by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in her Five Stages of Grief. So almost always the first question I get is one of denial.
Yes.
Right? So the first comment or the first question is something like, no, that can't happen. That can't happen unless we're too clever. We'll find a way out. You know, absolute denial.
We'll find a technological solution. Obama will suddenly become Lincoln and transform the whole vision of the environment, etc. Endless magical formulae come up.
Right. And as pointed out in the Refereed Journal literature, a paper by Tim Garrett, who's at the University of Utah, points out, written in 2007, published in 2009, and he's had a couple of follow-up papers that reinforce this point. Civilization is a heat engine in any form. So the only way to prevent runaway climate change, prevent runaway greenhouse, and remember this is from 2007, is to immediately cease all civilization. Well, We didn't stop in 2007. Since then, we've learned about those four dozen self-reinforcing feedback loops with respect to climate change, and most notably, methane coming out of the Arctic Ocean. It's pretty clear that methane released from the Arctic Ocean has gone exponential.
So most people wouldn't consider these topics dinner conversation. And I've seen the frustration countless times talking to people in person, but mainly on Facebook from people that are in the support various support groups that we belong to. About how they cannot have a conversation with people, and that's why they're in the support groups, and that's why they listen to this show. Any suggestions on how to have this conversation?
Yeah, you know, that was Andrew Harvey, and I had a conversation with him that lasted about an hour, again, about a month ago, and then I saw him again when I was in the Bay Area just a few days ago. And how do we have this conversation? He's attempting to do it through his workshops on mysticism. I'm attempting to do it here, mm-hmm. online and through the blog. But how do we have them in person? Well, that's a lot tougher issue, and most people just run.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I don't know how to have the conversation. Even the people I used to be close to, I'm not close to anymore.
Right.
Because this is such a bummer. Such a turnoff of a conversation. You know, nobody wants to talk about.
Yeah.
And especially in this culture where we deny death, we deny grieving, we deny anything associated with the funeral industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that. I'm not a big fan of the funeral industry. But it's just an artifice, the end point of where we're all headed anyway.
It's interesting how people, I guess, take this information. I and my wife took this information very differently than actually most people I know. I know a few other people that took it similarly, but I haven't met them in person, other than yourself, that we really took it as an opportunity. And we took it as an opportunity to do something that we probably would have never done. And we completely, what it did is it kind of, when your computer starts to go and it starts to scale, you know, and you can sit, the screen starts to scale. That's what happened to our lives. It just kind of fell to the ground, and it was like a mosaic, and we could start to see the parts, and we're like, this is dumb. Why don't we do something completely different and something we've always wanted to try and do that we never would otherwise? And so we had Joseph Zumach on the show, I think our second or third episode, and he brought up one time at, I think, a premiere of one of the films you were in, about this is an opportunity to do anything you ever wanted to do. And so many people put their head in the sand, or they project so far, this is what's going to happen, and it just takes them to places that are so dark and they become paralyzed by it.
Right. A couple of things there. The people who do absorb the message in a healthy manner, many of those people find it liberating, mm-hmm. as you and Karen found it liberating, as I find it liberating.
Yeah.
When I was in Chico and the event is about to start, some guy comes up to me and he says, "Are you afraid?"
Yeah.
I said, "Of what?" He says, "Well, you could get trapped somewhere." I said, "Excuse me?"
Yeah.
You know, I'm in this culture. Yeah. I'm already trapped.
This is the biggest trap, by the
exactly.
way.
This is the best mouse trap ever.
Right.
And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he says, "Well, you travel, and so you could get stuck somewhere and not be able to get home." And I said, "Yeah, I suppose that could happen."
Yeah.
But what I'm doing, what I love to do.
Yeah.
And so, I don't really feel comfortable telling people to do what they love. And then I need to stop doing what I love because I'm afraid of something.
Yeah.
It's just, and that's just emblematic of the people in the culture.
And that's what they project that. They just,
right.
they put themselves in literally in these scenarios, and they create new narratives and new stories about what will be or what will happen. And it literally, they start playing that role. And it just, all they're doing is transferring their life that they don't like right now to a life that they're not going to like then.
Right, right. One of the things I learned from the retreat at the Dharma Center in Winnipeg just over a year ago. So we're at this Buddhist Dharma Center. And I learned from the Lama there that hope and fear are the twin sides of I don't know the future coin.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't predict the future with any accuracy at all. So we project hope or fear onto it.
Right.
I hope things are going to go this way so I can have my 401k and blah, blah. Or I fear that the future is going to look like this, and that causes me to act in a certain way.
Right.
And both of those really heavily influence how we act today.
Yeah.
And the point of that exercise, of that discussion, was maybe we should ignore all that and live here now.
Yeah, and you know, I granted that's easier said than done because we are people, we are a culture that lives in the past and in the future, and very, you know, very little in the present. And I'm going through this myself, although I think at some point you have to make a decision that whatever you're doing isn't working for you. You know, if you're in this place where you're not happy, and then you're projecting about this place that's not going to make you happy, you have to make a decision that, do I want to continue to do that? Because what's happening to you right now are neither of those things in
right.
most cases.
Right, exactly.
What's happening is you're just thinking about them right there.
And of course it's difficult.
Yeah.
You know, because we're so heavily influenced by what has happened in the past. We're part of this culture. We were born into captivity, as it were. And also, of course, I'm still flossing my teeth.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm thinking about the future
right.
at some level
yeah.
because I haven't given up on brushing my teeth.
Well, we stick close together on this interview. I appreciate that.
So. And, you know, I'm still showering on a kind
sure.
of regular basis.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I'm going to see the end of the day.
Yeah. So, I mean, so part of that, in a sense, is routine. And it carries over to the larger aspects of our lives. And the routine is to project what's going to happen to you in the future and worry about it.
Right. And one of the projections people make is when I point out, using Paul Beckwith's work, that we're likely to experience a 5 or 6 degrees C temperature rise within a decade or two,
mm-hmm.
almost everybody who does soak that in, almost everybody who understands what that means,
right.
that means lack of habitat, immediately goes to, oh, so I'm going to die on November 27th, 2034. Everybody's going to die at
yeah.
that last possible minute,
right.
that last possible second.
Right.
There'll be no gradation along the way.
Yeah.
So there's projection again.
Right.
You know, if I were to say...
Makes for a hell of a movie.
It looks like all humans are going to be extinct on January 2nd,
yeah.
right, 2031.
Yeah.
Then everybody I spoke to would say, oh, I better get my affairs in order on January 2nd then.
Well, and for those who believe in the rapture, it's this Friday.
Oh, coffee today.
That's right.
This Friday is the rapture.
Or as I call it, free clothes day.
and tell about the... Your story that came up with the guy who's in the music group who thinks that there's going to be a rapture.
The guy who's in the music group?
You know, I can't remember his name, but he's the one who said there's going to be a rapture and it's going to be this Friday. And he's
Oh, yeah. He's it's local community down here and they play music every Monday evening. And one of the guys in the group is a Christian of some sort. Who believes in the rapture, and he believes it's going to happen this Friday. And so I said to one of the members who's in the music group that when he shows up on Monday, because I don't think the rapture is going to happen, that you should just all have your instruments there with your clothes sitting next to them, and then he'll be the only one there going, shit, I guess I wasn't worthy. All of you were worthy.
Oh, that's going to freak him out, man.
And I'm just batshit crazy. But of course, you know, on some levels, I'm making fun of the guy, but that's how people look at the things we talk about on some level.
Yes, that's right. They think we're crazy because
yeah.
we talk about the things
yeah.
we talk about. We think everybody else is crazy because
yeah.
they don't understand right. the things we talk about.
Right.
And so that takes us right, I think, to what do we do?
So there's a next episode, 3 things we can do. Let's play that clip.
So despite your last, what you said about how you would be on all these mainstream media outlets if you would just give the 3 things you want people to do, what, and I'm not meaning this in terms of do, or maybe I am, so what do you want to have happen? Somebody hears this interview today And sorry, I hope that you take this in the spirit in which I say it. But so what do you want them to do?
Right.
And
that's a great question. And now these little episodes called The Edge of Extinction at my blog at Nature Bats Last. And they're just little 1 to 3 minute video clips as I talk into the camera. And I think there are two questions here. What do we do? And what do you do? What do we do as a society? And it's pretty clear that what we are doing as a society and what we will continue to do as a culture is to destroy every aspect of the living planet. But we as individuals don't have to participate in that. We as individuals do not have to go along with the status quo and kill everything for the sake of killing everything. We can reach some state of enlightenment instead. So what do we do culturally? I'm not sure. We need a complete replacement of the culture. What do we do as individuals? Well, a couple of things. What do you love? And I ask people this all the time. When I meet people, you know, the standard approach is, hi, nice to meet you. What do you do? And the question, of course, is what do you do to make money in this omnicidal money-generating culture? And so after I tell people that I do crazy things like take care of bees and milk goats and raise gardens and occasionally I speak in public, in addition to all those things, then I end with, what do you love? And if they haven't run out of the room screaming at the list of things I do that are incredibly countercultural, that last question certainly caused them to just take a few steps back. What do you love? That's weird. Why would you talk about that? So I think what we do as individuals, and what I promote people to as individuals, is tap into what they actually love. And I suspect for most people that is not part of this culture. They don't actually love going to the mall. They don't actually love going to the water park. They don't actually love driving to work to a meaningless job to make money so they can drive to work and stay in a shitty apartment and so on. That's not what they love. And so I'm just asking people to tap into what they love and pursue some wise words looping back again to the medical profession from a long time ago, first do no harm. So that doesn't sound like much, but by asking people to treat each other with decency, I think that's something. By asking people to treat each other with respect, I think that's kind of a big deal. To pursue what you actually love instead of a few more dollars so you can go to the nearest fast food restaurant, I think that's doing something as well. So those are the sorts of directions I try to point people in rather than the absurd culture that most people are embedded within and can't seem to break away from that has them just chasing the next dollar.
Well, thank you so much for that, and thank you for your work, Guy. And I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Guy McPherson. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
That excerpt is from an interview with Derek Jensen. It aired on Resistance Radio on this station in February. And I don't think between the two of us we could have said so more times in 4 minutes.
So what were the three things?
I was having a hard time keeping track, even though I listened to it later. I was trying to figure out, what were the four things? I think the four things were, do what you love.
There are only three, so good. You only have two left. Do
Uh-oh.
What you love.
Do what you
don't.
Love.
You don't have to participate.
Right. So opt out of participation, do what you love, and treat each other with
be
respect.
Nice.
Be nice. Basically, be nice. That's not nothing. I mean, people tell me all the time, I suggest doing nothing, that it's all roll over
right.
and die with me.
And for some of us, it's really hard, actually, to be nice. I'm not pointing any fingers.
It is hard to be nice.
And it's actually hard to do what you love in this culture.
Yes, it is. And that's why it's so countercultural.
I mean,
both of those are incredibly countercultural.
Oh, absolutely. I can count on probably one hand, maybe, the amount of people I know that truly, I think, love their job and mean it.
Right. Yeah, almost everybody says
I love my job.
But check with them on Monday morning at 7:30 a.m.
Or even worse, Sunday evening when you start to think about it.
When the dread starts to build.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's admittedly very difficult in this culture to break those bonds of culture and start doing the things you love and treating people with respect, because you don't really get ahead by treating people with decency, by treating them with respect, by acting like you actually love people.
And a lot of times you really don't have the time in your day to express those things.
Yeah, that's right.
So you buy something for them instead, or...
Yeah, I need to go to town today and buy something for my wife.
Right. But, it's true. That's what I found living out here and not having a job. Spending pretty much all day and every day with my wife, we're always together, so there's time to do things, and there's time to say things. And if you can't find that time when you have all the time, well, then maybe you're not with the right person or in the right situation. So.
Well, I love your story from yesterday when the local primitivist stopped by the Gare, and I don't remember what he said. He sort of knocked on that beautiful door on the Gare, and you're like hanging out there, you and Karen. And what did he say?
Oh, he called it a some sort of hippie place. I forget what the second word was, but some sort of hippie hangout or something like that. Yeah, because it's multicolored. It looks kind of kaleidoscope like and.
And then he had a comment about that kaleidoscope, like,
"Well, right, you don't want to go through your psychedelics in there, hallucinating in a kaleidoscope probably isn't the best."
Wait, this is a guy who lives at a camp in literally a mud hut that he built for himself, and he's calling your place a hippie camp,
right?
And talking about psychedelics in the first 3 minutes of the conversation.
But this is a guy that probably does the three things.
Yeah.
Really well, and he doesn't have to do it with a partner. He has a community around him, and he is probably as present as a human being as you'll ever find.
That's absolutely right, and I don't know anybody who works on something he loves with such disregard for the time it takes.
Yeah.
You know, he makes these masks, and he weaves things, and it might take him a 1,000 hours.
Yeah, he said something interesting yesterday. I'm paraphrasing, but he said, "I just don't have an interest in money. It's not something that drives me at all.
Right.
And not that he never uses money, but it's anybody I've ever come across, or even the few people you read about in some of these articles, the man that lives without money, and he's right there."
And he does use money occasionally. In fact, he brought some by yesterday.
Yeah, he has money.
Right.
But,
boy,
he doesn't have to use it too often because he gathers and he makes everything. And
he lives just unbelievably simply in a way that most people in the dominant culture would just find anathema.
Right. And in this particular community, most folks, by the standard of living, live pretty simply. But then you go and see him.
Right.
You're like, geez, I'm living up or something.
Exactly. I got like 4 changes of clothes.
Yeah.
I'm living large. And a washing machine to wash it in.
Right.
Ooh.
You're like, I've committed one of the 7 deadly sins when I go see that guy.
Speaking of sucking the straw of culture, of civilization, let's run that next clip, which is called Sucking the Straw.
All right.
Yes, mostly it's drought-related. Here in Northern California, there are still hundreds of people who haven't had water coming through the taps for several months now because the aquifer is dropping. Now, do you blame that on climate change? I came over what used to be a lake this morning on my way here from Ashland, Oregon, and there's no lake there anymore. I think that's because of 2 things, because we're sucking on the straw, and we keep sucking on the straw, and because there's been no recharge. And the aquifers date back to the Pleistocene. So that's 2-million-year-old water there that only within the last 100 years we started sucking out of the ground, and nobody's thinking about stopping. So both of those, the root of both of those is industrial civilization. So if you're looking for an ultimate cause, I think that's where the cause lies. So it's water, it's food, it's starvation, it's too hot. So far, it hasn't been, in almost any cases, wet bulb temperature of 35 degrees centigrade or 95 degrees Fahrenheit, at which point the body just can't thermoregulate, large mammals like us. Even if you're in a shower spraying cold water, when the wet bulb temperature is 95 degrees, we die in a matter of hours. So far that hasn't been the case, but at some point in the not-too-distant future, it's likely to occur, especially in tropical and subtropical regions near the coast.
Actually, I'd need to make a correction. If you're standing in a cold shower, you will be dumping heat fast enough that you will survive 95 degrees Fahrenheit wet bulb temperature, but you better not come out of the shower.
Stay in that little cube.
And as pointed out, the water's running out, so you're not going to be able to stand in that shower forever.
Yeah, this clip reminds me of There Will Be Blood, where Daniel Day-Lewis's character, at the end, the guy's finally going to sell him his land. He goes, I don't need your land anymore because I sucked it dry. I took my straw and went underneath your land. I drank your milkshake.
That's
right. And, I mean, that's in essence what we're doing. We're just going in, and I think as we get closer and closer to regions and places running out of water, you're going to have water wars, even domestically.
Well, and right now we have water wars against the future.
Yeah.
Right? We're sucking their straw.
Yeah.
And we've been doing that for a long time, and it's having impacts right now so that current people in California are suffering. But that problem is only going to get worse, obviously.
Yeah.
There's that predicament. Since this clip came out, a NASA scientist within the last couple of weeks has said that California has 1 year of water left.
Wow.
Those aquifers are just keeps getting sucked dry, and it's not raining.
Yeah.
They're in the midst of a drought that, according to the Referee Journal literature, will never end. Forever is a long time,
yeah,
especially toward the end.
Towards the end, right. It's almost over.
But holy cow! I mean, for a relatively conservative outlet such as the Journal literature to make a statement like that is astonishing.
And I think people, their first reaction is, whew, I don't live in California. California produces a lot of food.
Yes. Yes, like 99% of the nuts we eat in this country, the almond, as they call them there.
Yeah,
the almond. What we know as almonds. And I mean, really, a tremendous amount of food.
And dairy, I mean.
Yeah. I mean, and it's, if it were a separate country, it would be the eighth largest economy in the world.
Right. So if you have the eighth largest economy in the world, and it's your neighbor, and it's part of your economy, and it collapses.
That might be problematic. Is that what you're saying?
Right. I mean, for all intentional purposes, could that collapse the U.S. economy? The California economy going down?
I can't see how it wouldn't.
Yeah.
I mean, if California goes down, I can't imagine that the rest of the country wouldn't go down with it.
All the electoral votes.
Yeah, that's going to be a problem for Ted Cruz, isn't it?
Right, and they're going to be movies. Still, right?
Of course there will be movies.
Good, okay.
Because they'll move Hollywood inland.
Right, true.
Because that's where the money is.
Yeah, they'll be our neighbors. Yeah. Right on. So we have what? You want to do one more clip?
Yeah, let's do one more clip. Maybe Beyond Human Intervention looks like a good one to play next, and then we'll wrap this up.
All right.
Can you talk for just a moment about one of the reasons that you believe that that the warming will happen so quickly, having to do with what some people call tipping points, what some people call feedback loops, what some people call reinforcement. So those, like the methane, can you talk about that for just a moment first?
Yes, absolutely. We have triggered self-reinforcing feedback loops that feed upon themselves. And so it's no longer simply a matter of tweaking the thermostat so that we can turn down the heat. Rather, the thermostat has run out of control. It's as if the boiler room is capable automatically of fueling itself and bringing more coal into the room without humans being involved at this point. So it's pretty apparent that we have Arctic methane, methane coming out of the Arctic Ocean at a very, very rapid rate, apparently an exponential rate. And so
Even if we were to stop all industrial activity today, even if we were to remove all humans from the planet today, there is no evidence that we would be able to stop that methane from leaking out of the Arctic Ocean, not to mention the dozens of other places coming out of the Earth.
All right. So that, again, is an interview with Derek Jensen on Resistance Radio on this station from back in February.
So, the whole methane thing, that's really, besides, you know, the collapse of civilization and all these power plants, nuclear power plants, that's really the kick in the pants.
Yeah, that's the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about, that the IPCC in their vaunted fifth assessment mentioned twice in a single table as, you know, a problem for the grandchildren, that sort of thing.
That's the predicament.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really, really big deal. The latest evidence indicates that it's gone exponential in the atmosphere, and it has a warming potential of more than 100 times more powerful than carbon dioxide in the short term. So
do what you love.
Ouch. Yes.
Only the love remains, guy.
Yes. At the end of extinction, only love remains. There you go.
Well, that about wraps it up for this week. Make sure to like us on our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.fm. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show, and please continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday evening, and if you missed the show, make sure to find us on the archives at PRN.fm and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to all the contributions and to Aprazin for our intro song. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
Nature Bats Last.
Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you. She's gonna get you, gonna get you, you betcha.
Turn around. The loving planet is about to make a comeback, and that's really, really good news.